Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Robert McGruer will be on to talk about sex and disability. The war over abortion in Michigan gets comical, and some parents in a small town in Washington want their kids to learn about sex from older kids on the playground instead of responsible adults. Sister Simone Campbell of Network, a progressive nuns group, went on Stephen Colbert recently to talk about her battle with the Vatican, which is trying to discipline the nuns for concentrating on helping people instead of fighting abortion and gay rights.
Now, sister, you and your fellow nuns have clearly gone rogue, okay? You're radical feminists.
We're certainly oriented towards the needs of women and responding to their needs. If that's radical, I guess we are. But actually,
yes, yes, that's radical feminism.
I don't think so.
No, it is.
Colbert has really been doing an amazing job on his show of demonstrating that actual Catholics in the pews don't agree with the Vatican's radical agenda when it comes to reproductive rights and gay rights. Check out the whole interview. The state of Michigan is in an economic crisis. Many towns are basically in bankruptcy, its biggest city is becoming synonymous with the concept of city failure, and the unemployment rate is at 8.5%. Which is all certainly why the state legislature thinks it has all the time and energy in the world to devote to expensive attacks on women's right to choose. The House passed one of what will probably be a series of bills that will eventually be folded into a super monster set of abortion regulations. It's the single most aggressive attack on abortion rights I think I've ever seen, at least in my adult life. And the ambitions of the anti-choice legislators pushing this are huge, as was explained by pro-choice state representative Lisa Brown on Melissa Harris Perry's show.
And it's part of a package of bills that were actually written by Right to Life. And, the bill that we voted on that I spoke to does a lot of things. It was a 45-page long bill, so Herman Cain wouldn't have liked it very much. But, it's really, in fact, one of my Republican colleagues commented that he hopes this bill would put an end to abortion. So it's really kind of a backdoor way of trying to really overturn Roe versus Wade.
She's referring to the 20-week abortion ban when talking about a challenge to Roe. This ban and all 20-week abortion bans are in direct violation of the Supreme Court's trimester schedule guiding when states can restrict abortion. The hope is that they can get a lawsuit up to the Supreme Court level on this and get Roe completely overturned. I'm not entirely convinced that the legal strategy behind this anti-choice push makes a whole lot of sense, but that is absolutely their intention. Luckily, the Michigan governor appears to be in the process of quietly making that part of all this go away. It's worth noting that anyone who thinks they can get rid of abortion is a fool. Time and time again, history has shown that you can only end legal abortion, but that women who want to terminate pregnancies are going to find a way whether it's legal or not. Chloe from Feministing was also on the program, and she explained some of what this bill does.
So this bill has restrictions on clinics for insurance premiums and also for practicing, which would put, I think, a lot of clinics out of business. It has a ban on telemedicine, which is a huge thing for women who live in rural or isolated areas where they can't get to the nearest clinic. So no longer can they get a prescription over the phone for RU486, the abortion pill, which makes
for rural women, this is a really big deal.
Right, which turns this into an economic issue, like we were talking earlier. It's not just a single issue abortion issue, it's an economic issue, because if you can't get a telemedicine prescription, you have to take time off work, drive to the nearest clinic, pay for a hotel, and it becomes inaccessible.
Those are the big points, but there's actually even more stuff in there, including scripts to be read, a confusing requirement to screen for coercion, and a bunch of stuff about disposing fetal remains that I worry might not only be a pain for abortion providers, but any OBGYN who works with miscarrying women. Unfortunately, it's sometimes hard to really get attention for yet another state-level assault on reproductive rights, because it's just a constant thing now, and people are fatigued. To make it worse, since one side disingenuously claims that this is about life, it's hard to get the larger public to understand that this is actually about sex panic and anti-feminist sentiment. But we got lucky this time, because the Michigan Republicans who controlled the state house gave the game away and made it clear exactly how much they hate female sexuality and female empowerment. They banned Representative Lisa Brown from speaking again during the House debates for a number of days. She went on the local news show to discuss it.
Absolutely. I still don't know what I was punished for.
Well, you were punished for using a word that some people, at least they said, they found offensive. And looking back, in retrospect, if you have respect for the body of the House of Representatives, could you have chosen a different word? Why did you think that word was necessary?
Well, that is the anatomically correct word. It is in Michigan statute in three different places. I don't see what's wrong with using the word vagina.
That's right. The word vagina is what got her banned. Once again, you have legislators who treat the vagina like it's the scariest thing in the world, too scary to be said out loud, even as you're trying to pass laws trying to take away an individual's right to control her own. One of the male representatives actually said, and I quote, "What she said was offensive. It was so offensive, I don't even want to say it in front of women. I would not say that in mixed company," end quote. In other words, he believes that vaginas are only an appropriate topic of conversation amongst men. No wonder he so desperately wants to take away a woman's right to control her vagina. He doesn't think she should even be able to hear, much less speak of the thing that's in her own body. For reference, here's the comment Representative Brown made on the House floor.
"Finally, Mr. Speaker, I'm flattered that you're all so interested in my vagina, but no means no."
Anti-choicers know that it hurts their cause every time people catch on to the fact that they're a bunch of woman-fearing prudes. They know they're supposed to pretend to be all cool with sex while working to pass policies to punish women for having it. But they just can't help themselves sometimes, and their eternal panic at, say, hearing the word vagina just comes spilling out, exposing their real agenda for the whole world to see. I'd like to welcome Robert McCruer to the program. Robert is a professor of English at George Washington University, and his work focuses on queer and crip cultural studies and critical theory. He's the co-editor with Anna Morrow of a new book called Sex and Disability, and he's here to talk about just that, sex and disability. Welcome to RealityCast, Robert.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. What inspired you to put together this collection of essays?
Well, it came about from actually a conference panel that was organized at the Modern Language Association by one of our contributors, Tobin Sievers, who writes the opening essay, A Sexual Culture for Disabled People, in the volume. He had organized basically just a panel that was called Sex and Disability at the conference, and Anna Malo and I were both on it, talking about very different things than we ended up writing about in the volume. I was talking about the performance artist Bob Flanagan, and she was talking about other things connected to disability and SM and a range of topics. But after the conference, basically, long story short, Anna decided we really need to make an anthology that deals with some of these issues, and not just have it be something that's a panel presentation and a one-time affair. So we approached a couple of presses, and eventually Duke University Press decided that they agreed with us, and the volume was born.
So I'm sure a lot of my listeners don't know who Bob Flanagan is, so can you kind of explain that reference a little bit?
Bob Flanagan, who died in the late 90s, 1998, I believe, was a performing artist with cystic fibrosis, who was in a very long and interesting relationship with a lover slash mistress named Sherry Rose. And they did a lot of performance art around SM that often entailed performances where one called Visiting Hours in particular that was at the Modern, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, where she came in and would, there was sort of an SM performance around his hospital bed. The interesting thing was that it sort of combined disability and sexuality, because of course cystic fibrosis often entails needing to have the mucus cleared from the lungs, and so they incorporated this into their performances. He was famous for many, many other quite extreme performances, and he lived much, much longer than many people with cystic fibrosis often do. In fact, he used to perform on stage in a coffin, saying, I'm Bob Flanagan, I'm supposed to be dead already. And then he would go on and talk about his life and sexuality. And it was very affirming for a really open expression of sex and sexuality for disabled people.
Which is an interesting question, because I think kink is already an uncomfortable issue generally. And then when you introduce disability, it becomes even more upsetting for a lot of people. And and one of the essays in your book is about amputee devotion and why it's unnerving for so many people. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that essay by Allison Kafer is really, it's a wonderful piece, and is in that final section of the book that is called Desires, where we try to include four actually quite edgy essays dealing with complicated, controversial topics. And Allison Kafer's essay is it's called Desire and Disgust, or uses Desire and Disgust in the title, and she's very careful about the ways in which amputee devotees, usually men, who are specifically attracted to usually women who have had amputations, she's very careful to not just recoil from that desire, because she doesn't want to pathologize men who find bodies like hers, say, beautiful. But she does in that essay want to question the ways in which the desire is caught up, of course, in all sorts of other patriarchal and able-bodied issues and gazes. And so she basically writes her way towards understanding that most of the men who are involved in these devotee subcultures are not really grounded in the disability movement or in disability history. And she writes quite beautifully towards alternative visions of finding disability beautiful. Specifically, she looks at the writing of Eli Clare and Samuel Lurie, who are lovers. And Lurie has written about the ways in which he finds his lover's disability very sexy, but not as a sort of fetishized, not as a sort of fetish, but rather as something that is just part of the eros between the two of them, the love between the two of them, when he feels his lover's hand, who has cerebral palsy, trembling on his neck. He finds it very erotic and exciting, but it's in the context of disability culture and the disability movement. And so Kafer sort of rides that desire, disgust, binary to put forward a very complicated and exciting essay.
In the intro to your book, you describe sex and disability as, in the popular imagination, as incongruous. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there have been, we have a section called Histories, and I think a lot of that has to do with historical stereotypes that have plagued disabled people for a few centuries. And those stereotypes include the stereotype of the over-sexual, potentially violent disabled person. And Michelle Jarman's essay in the volume specifically looks at the ways in which historically racialized bodies and disabled bodies were seen as dangerous and needing to be controlled or eliminated for their dangerous sexuality. So that stereotype has existed, but also the stereotype that disabled people might perhaps be completely without sexuality, pure, innocent, undesiring and undesirable. And those stereotypes have been quite strong and persistent, and it's really taken the disability movement and disability culture and disability performers and disability memoirists to change those ideas. And they've changed those ideas in incredibly vibrant ways, and some of the pieces in the book include personal narrative. There's a beautiful personal narrative by the painter Rita Lehr that incorporates some of her own quite erotic paintings. There's a personal narrative by the performing artist Leslie Fry that looks at her own non-normative body and the ways in which that non-normative body has been incorporated into her sexual life and desire. And there is a piece on autistic memoirs and sexuality. So my point is that these stereotypes have been persistent, but they have also, especially over the past several decades, been challenged in so many ways.
Which leads me to my I think, last question about this, and I like to end these things on positive notes. Do you think, I know that pop culture has generally been reinforcing of the notion that disabled people sexually are either monstrous or like desexualized. But do you feel that there has been any improvement? Can you think of good examples in like just popular culture where that narrative is challenged and we have a more positive image?
Mm-hmm. The thing is, I think that more and more images of disabled people are showing up in popular culture as a whole, sometimes in still problematic ways, but I think that in performance in particular, there's just really amazing work that's being done right now. I think probably at the tip of most disability studies practitioners' tongues would be the group Sins Invalid, which is based in the Bay Area. And they're a dance and performance group that is about celebrating the non-normative body. I think that the self-described porn star, Laurie Erickson, who is a graduate student at York University in Toronto, has made amazing videos, especially one called Want, that has been crossing borders and showing up everywhere. It's a beautiful 10-minute short about her own, and quite graphic short about her own desire and lies. I think that Leroy Moore's group Quip Hop Nation, all of these performances really celebrate disabled bodies, non-normative bodies, and a range of desires that can't be reduced to just a single coherent identity, which the volume is really about celebrating that sex is really not necessarily identity consolidating, but about shattering the identities that we believe we have and reaching for new possibilities.
My guest today has been Robert McRuer. The book is called Sex and Disability, and you can find it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Robert.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Today, in the news of why we can't have nice things, a handful of Washington State parents, and of course a bunch of anti-choice websites, are flipping out because an elementary school principal acted like a grown-up during a fifth grade course in sex education. What happened was that the school takes the kids aside and puts them through what sounds like a pretty standard issue, age-appropriate sex education course. They addressed HIV and STD prevention, and then open up the floor to questions, which is something all responsible sex educators do. Your students are the best guide for knowing what they need to know. If they're asking questions about it, they usually have a reason. In this case, a student asked about oral and anal sex, and the principal answered directly without starting a five-alarm fire over it.
After they say that a sex ed class became too graphic, they say the information was just too racy for fifth graders.
As reported by one parent, her child remembered the so-called racy description as, quote, "You take a man's penis and you put it in your mouth. That's what girls do to the boys. The boys spread the girls' legs apart and put their mouths down on the vaginas," end quote. What I want to know is how sexually deprived the adults must be to find that description to be racy. I found it unarousing. That way of describing sex is like libido kryptonite. It's so unhot, it was probably enough to keep the kids from sexually experimenting at least a year later than they would have otherwise. But the way some parents are reacting, you'd think the school showed the girls porn movies. And yes, all outraged reports I read only talked about the girls, because no one seems to mind if the boys hear this stuff.
Basically how I feel, and others that I've talked to, it's just the same as raping somebody, but you're raping their innocence instead of their physical being.
Setting aside the extreme offensiveness of equating knowing that sex exists to being raped, here is what is so messed up about this guy's outrage. A student asked the question. That should dispel the notion that these kids are floating along, blissfully unaware that genitals exist or that people use them to get pleasure. It seems part of the problem here is that many of the girls had been deliberately shielded from any sexual information by their parents, and so hearing about this all for the first time was upsetting. I get that. But a kid in the class asked the question. So what we can say for certain is that the knowledge that anal and oral sex exist is already in the student population. And kids love to brag about how much they know about grown-up stuff to each other. So the parents have two options for how their daughters hear about this stuff. The girls can learn it from a responsible educator who uses unadorned, unarousing, factually accurate language. Or they can hear it from their peers, who are probably going to make it sound even more exotic and scary and traumatizing than the boring old principal ever could. I'm a little unclear on exactly how the principal was supposed to answer this question if the parents think accuracy was off the table, by making stuff up so that their kids get even more confused. This was the point made by the superintendent, who is standing by the principal.
In reality, she stuck to the curriculum, and it's pretty difficult to talk about STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, without explaining what that is.
He also says parents are always sent a notice so they can review the curriculum and choose to excuse their child.
Kids leaving fifth grade and moving into middle school start getting exposed to a lot more information, and we know that that's the age many children start becoming sexually active, unfortunately.
The reason that they hit them up with this stuff before they leave elementary is they know that when the kids move up to junior high school, the playground chatter about sex rises exponentially. Already you have kids who know terms like oral sex and anal sex. The idea is to have a responsible adult clarify stuff to kids before they hear it from their peers. And they will. That's not something you can stop. These parents really should ask if they want their daughters to learn what sex is from the principal or from an older kid at the junior high school. One more thing is important here. Some parents complained not that there was sex ed, but that it talked about non-procreative acts. In other words, they said they'd be fine talking about sex as long as no one mentioned that people do it for pleasure, or that it should be fun for you. But that is dangerous in and of itself, as Dan Savage recently explained on his podcast.
And I like to cite the study from the UK about 5 years ago that found that many young people, when they first became sexually active, were engaged in sex acts, were having sex that was painful and unpleasurable, that they did not enjoy, because sex education didn't cover pleasure, because nobody in any of the sex ed classes that these kids had told them that sex was supposed to feel good. So they didn't go into their first sexual relationships with partners expecting sex to be anything but painful. And a partner could take advantage of their ignorance and tell them that this is the way it's supposed to be. And people, male and female, but mostly female, were submitting to sex acts, doing things with somebody who claimed to love them that they didn't enjoy, that were unpleasurable, that were painful, because they didn't understand that that wasn't supposed to be that way.
I realize a lot of parents think shielding your kids from knowing about sex is the best way to prevent them from being traumatized. But in reality, ignorance isn't bliss. Ignorance makes you an easy target for those who want to hurt and abuse you. If you want to protect girls from sexual trauma, arm them with information.
When I get down, you know I get down. When I get around, you know I get around. When I get down.
And now for the wisdom of wingnuts, things get real at Fox News Edition. Gretchen Carlson finally got fed up of the constant on-air sexist jokes from her male colleagues and walked off the set at Fox.
Women are everywhere. We're letting them play golf and tennis now. It's out of control.
You know what?
You know.
You know what?
She's out.
You read the headlines, since men are so great. Go ahead. Take them away.
All right, finally.
Take them away.
Okay. Leaving an all-male crew.
In all your glory. Go for it.
In all my glory. Now to your headlines. She needed a shower.
It was played off as a joke, but the fact remains that there's a lot of tension at Fox between its overt anti-woman agenda and the number of high-profile pundits and anchors on the network that are female.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.